Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about Great Britain's class system on the eve of the Second World War. Now, one of the things that's interesting about the 1930s is that you can see trends in British social history that later become very dominant in the 1960s, 70s, and even the 1980s. In their kind of embryonic form in the 1930s, a decline in deference, the erosion of the assumption that women were second-class citizens and there really to obey the whims of their husbands, questions of sexual morality, which became areas of public debate in the 60s, 70s and 80s, were gradually beginning to change. As early as the 1930s, an era where male homosexuality was still illegal, the idea that there was such a thing as female homosexuality was barely kind of a concept as far as public discourse went, where sex before marriage only really occurred probably when an engagement had been decided, and having children out of wedlock was a source of immense shame. So there are the beginnings of these sorts of social changes. But the one that I find most compelling is the attitude towards social class. And the 1930s is an era where the middle classes begin to really dominate as a social group. The upper classes, who had been in steady decline throughout the second half of the 19th century and whose estates were gradually less and less valuable, less and less important sources of income, who faced growing death duties, who had lost significant numbers of their ranks in the First World War, were a kind of a declining group in the 1930s. Today we're going to look at Britain's War by Daniel Todman. It's a stunning book. It's the first volume of a two-part series that runs from before the war, 1937, up to 1941. Social class defined probably most societies in the mid-1930s, but Great Britain seems to be a kind of a lightning rod almost for the discussion of class. Other supposedly more egalitarian societies like the US tried to kind of avoid the discussion of class, or to look upon social class as being a kind of a quaint European tradition, even though it was kind of abundantly present in any modern industrialized society. Daniel Todman writes, "When mass observers recounted the coronation, they talked about class to describe the differences within their society. Like many Britons, they could place themselves and others easily within three categories, upper, middle, and working, by using speech, dress, and behaviour as indicators of income, occupation, and family background." So the organisation, Mass Observation, which was one of the very first social research organisations in Britain, was able to give a kind of, throughout the 1930s and the war, and thereafter, a kind of running commentary about social change, often done from what we would now look on today as being a relatively unscientific basis. But they were they had specific classifications for what represented different types of social class, and used some fairly broad and often kind of arbitrary or what might seem prejudicial ways of indicating this, particularly looking at speech, dress, and behaviour. The landed aristocracy had been gradually in decline, as mentioned, throughout the 19th century. And it had been land specifically and land ownership that had been the marker of aristocratic status. Throughout the 19th century, a new mercantile bourgeoisie, a new industrial bourgeoisie, had emerged and had often been able to use the wealth created by an industrial revolution to kind of eclipse the landed aristocracy in their wealth and power. However, there's still kind of a deep cultural focus on the affairs of the aristocracy. Society columns and things like the Pall Mall Gazette and other newspapers that would follow the various affairs of different aristocrats, and the culture of flattering write-ups about society balls and events that ordinary people have no access to. Daniel Todman writes, "Numerically tiny and socially concentrated in an area before widespread home ownership, the upper class remained at the end of the 1930s extremely rich relative to the rest of the population. The best off 1% of the population retained well over half of the nation's wealth." So obviously this came under assault by a long period of social democracy throughout the 20th century. By, I think, 1975, wealth inequality was at the lowest it had ever been. And from 1976 onwards, it begins to gradually tick upwards until we've reverted to rather similar levels of wealth inequality now. Essentially social democracy was rolled back by neoliberal ideas. The Windsor family, the royal family, the wealthiest of the aristocracy, had been carefully rebranded by George V, the king's father who died in 1936, as representatives of Britishness, representatives of virtue, of stability, and of charitable endeavour. This was a trick really that had been pioneered by Prince Albert in the 19th century, when, following his marriage to Queen Victoria, he rather sensibly asked, what is it if a member of the royal family has no direct role in government? What do they do? What is their purpose? We better kind of imagine one before other people start to ask that question. And so Prince Albert started the tradition of royals being patrons of arts, science, engineering, agriculture, and all supposedly positive things. The vehicle by which the aristocracy retained power, even though many of them had lost overt political power, was the Conservative Party. And the combination of the Conservative Party, of the ability to monopolise key positions within the armed forces, and the ability to retain certain perks and privileges and social ranks, meant that the new aristocracy began to mingle not only with the rising industrial bourgeoisie of Great Britain. At certain gentlemen's clubs, lords and aristocrats would smoke cigars with Cunard magnates and railway barons and people who had made vast amounts of money through coal, through publishing, and other industries. But also a rising global plutocracy. The wealthy of other countries who had perhaps sent their children to be educated in Great Britain spent their time rubbing shoulders with the British aristocracy. And a complex system of interconnected friendships, relationships, and mutual associations obviously emerged. And in the heart of all of this, of course, is the city of London. The affairs of financially savvy members of the upper classes were managed through the City of London and often in exchanges such as the New York Stock Exchange, which show a kind of the beginnings of globalised finance. Winston Churchill himself, in the run-up to the Wall Street crash, took a steamship to New York to find out for himself whether the rumours of a stock market crash were true. And Britain's aristocracy was also able to purchase itself a kind of cultural capital by being patrons of rising stars in the gramophone and cinema industry. Ivor Novello was invited to many parties at country houses and aristocratic estates. So the association between rising cultural stars and a fading aristocracy tended to do a lot to try to keep the aristocracy appearing at least kind of contemporary. However, the real story of the 1930s is about the middle classes, and Daniel Todman writes, "For all its public prominence, the upper class was less and less politically influential. Locally and nationally, public life was dominated by middle-class men. The middle classes, the widest sector of society in terms of range of income, made up about a quarter of the population. They included rich business owners whose fortunes carried them to the edge of the upper class, of an upper-class lifestyle, and the lawyers, doctors, clergymen and military officers who traditionally made up the professional middle class. The changes in the economy since the start of the century had greatly increased the number of clerks and salesmen, then generally identified as making up the lower middle class. The middle classes were therefore growing, and the most striking development of the 1930s was the emergence of a new stratum of salaried technicians, engineers, managers, draftsmen and scientists required in the up-to-the-minute industries. It was the lower middle classes, I think, that offered the Conservative Party one of the most promising opportunities for continuance of power in an age of mass democracy, trade unions and a growing labour movement.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com, code program.
And the story that the Conservative Party told the lower middle classes was one of aspiration, that home ownership, savings, prudence, low taxes, and a spirit of enterprise and getting ahead was part of the offer, which was an entirely kind of individualistic one, that the collectivism of trade union membership and of the collective institutions of labour life, the working men's club, the pub, the trade union, were antithetical to the aspirations of the lower middle class. And the lower middle classes are just economically vulnerable enough to find this story very appealing. The idea that in a matter of years, or perhaps in the matter of a generation, that the family can make it up the social ladder to a position that's more financially secure, and where there is a greater chance of social kudos and acceptance for them. The lives of the lower middle classes are really very different from the top echelons of the British bourgeoisie. A successful British businessman who might make several thousand pounds a year, live in a large detached suburban house and actually have live-in servants, because obviously during the 1930s, service is one of the big employers in Britain, might have a couple of children at public school and be able to afford such luxuries as a telephone, a car, and holidays, perhaps in the Great Britain, or even overseas holidays. Lived a very different kind of life from the draftsman or the small business owner, the small shopkeeper, or the technician, who might live in on an income maybe 10 times smaller, so you're talking a few hundred pounds a year, who would live in a kind of a small suburban mortgaged house, might have a season ticket for the train, so rely heavily on public transport, and have one child or two children going through grammar school system. The thing that kind of unites the two, the aspiration and the philosophy that unites the two, because one might, you know, conceivably argue that these two people with supposedly within the same social class have actually kind of slightly different class interests. The thing that unites the two is the interest in home ownership and the belief that home ownership is available for all and is a virtue that all will enjoy, and something that will not just lift the poor out of poverty, but will be a kind of a device for enriching the individual. Both social groups within the middle classes tended to look at paid for secondary education, private health insurance, private unemployed insurance, and private provision of the basics of life as being virtues. The idea of state assistance is seen as something for poorer people, something to be relatively embarrassed about or ashamed of. And this shame at charity, this shame at public assistance, filtered down into working class families as well. We tend to see the aspiration to having low taxes as being something of the 1980s, a thing of the era of Margaret Thatcher, but it's not. The middle classes of the 1930s had similar aspirations, and bear in mind that Margaret Thatcher herself came from this bourgeois world in the 1930s. Her worldview was shaped as a young woman in this time period. And it was the Great Depression that threw this comfortably ordered world, obviously, into crisis. The middle classes found that the economic slump and the business failure that went into it resulted in having to be more prudent with things like savings and family finances. Rarely did it involve the kind of unemployment that the working classes in places like South Wales, the North West, or Tyneside, or Northern Ireland experienced. Far from it. The loss of status that was experienced by the middle classes didn't really translate into long-term unemployment, mainly because in certain areas where there were kind of large concentrations of Britain's bourgeoisie, these tended to be the areas where new light industries were emerging, and these new light industries were responsible for creating generations of middle-class Britons. The middle classes benefited from falling house prices during the 1930s and from the boom in private house construction after about 1935 and the growing supply of new consumer goods that made life kind of easier, more convenient. And so living standards for middle class people overall considerably improved during the 1930s. And created a sort of like a culture of domesticity and suburbia. The writer John Betjeman writes kind of favourably about Metroland, which was a stretch of suburbia that runs from London all the way into Buckinghamshire, northwards up to kind of around Aylesbury, where there were small new towns connected by rail travel and new suburban houses, which he thought was really as close to an English heaven as imaginable. And something interesting begins to emerge in this period of time. Daniel Todman describes it as this. The domesticity that this encouraged was matched with a growing idealisation among the middle classes of the companionate marriage, in which husband and wife spent time and took decisions together, not least to limit the number of children they had, since middle-class families were relatively small and getting smaller. And here are the beginnings of social trends towards marriage and towards gender roles that perpetuate throughout the century. The conception of the modern marriage that seems to be dominant in Britain now, the idea of a relative degree of equality, or at least that's kind of the goal, with perhaps a smaller number of children, a greater participation between both genders in terms of work inside the home and outside the home, and finance has its kind of embryonic seeds in the 1930s, in the social changes of the 1930s. So not to suggest for a moment that married life in the 1930s was in any way as kind of liberal as it perhaps is meant to be now. But here we're interested in the beginnings of these sorts of social trends. And of course, women were legally entitled to enter professions, medicine, teaching, finance, and government work. And the expectations of women in the 1930s was beginning to transition and change. And it was relatively common for women to have replaced men at lower levels of white collar work, such as secretarial work and other kind of clerical sorts of positions, by the early 1930s. Most employers operated a marriage bar, which was only removed after the Second World War, which would require women to resign once they got married. And the resulting division between a basically male world of work and a female world of domesticity was still, to a greater extent, present throughout the 1930s, though beginning to slightly break down. And it was replicated politically, so despite the extension of the franchise to all women by the end of the 1920s, there were very few women in Parliament, and their voices were focused disproportionately on matters of things such as motherhood and social welfare. Women of wealth, society ladies, and some education were able to focus on voluntary efforts and good works and that sort of thing to improve the lot of the poor. But within, this would mean that they were forced to stay within certain conventional boundaries of what he was considered that female, that women knew about, of female expertise. And this would present them with a public role, but in a kind of a limited and genuinely male-dominated way. Most of these boundaries and limitations and in inverted commas, opportunities for women were sanctioned by men. The middle classes dominated both political parties throughout the 1920s and 30s, and the Liberals too. Whilst Labour was notionally a party of the working class, by and large it was dominated by bourgeois figures who had more in common socially with their conservative counterparts than often they did with their constituents. And it was through this means that the Labour movement and the Labour Party was somehow tamed during the 1930s and able to accept and compromise on key areas of public policy, particularly austerity after 1931. Anyway, thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. I hope you've enjoyed this and found it useful. All the best. Thank you, and bye-bye.